Hello, everyone. This is Space Cafe Podcast, and I am Marcus. It'll be a fun show today. I can promise you that already. Artificial intelligence and machine learning have been advertised. This was not hard to see in the title of this episode, but we're going to up the ante today. But one thing at a time. Our guest today has made it her business to bring companies to the other side, the side of digitalization. And if you believe the modern augurs of the technological world, no one will be exempt from this. In the next 10 years, at least in the business world, no stone will be left unturned as long as someone is still around to unturn those stones, if you look at the current state of the world. But this is another story. Our guest refers to what she calls the two-body method. Take an AI expert and an expert in another field and lock them in a room. Not literally, but something like that. What comes out of this has revolutionary potential every now and then. With today's topic, we will break out a little from our cozy, familiar space zone for which you come to us every 2 weeks. We are very grateful for this, by the way. Seriously, every tweet, every single mention, every 5-star rating helps this ship stay afloat and give you what you expect from the Space Cafe podcast. Some of the best and most interesting stories from the space industry. Thank you very much for that. Machine learning, unusual business ventures, and unusual businesses will be on the plate today. Ladies and gentlemen, I bring you Nicole Büttner, mastermind and CEO of the artificial intelligence venture studio Merantix.
Sorry, I had to start my recording again because my mom called me on FaceTime. Sorry.
So tell me, Nicole, what was the most nerve-wrenching problem you had today in your non-AI life? What was really getting on your nerves?
What was really getting on my nerves today?
Yes.
Actually, I had a really pleasant Sunday. And I have to say, I think my worst problem today was a very first world problem that the mixed mushroom polenta ponzu dish I ordered for brunch was not as expected. So you can probably see the scale of my problems are not really on the scale of outer space.
So would it be possible to automatize that problem and make it go away by letting machines take care of that?
So funnily enough, right, AI really flourishes in environments where you have a lot of big data sets. And you could say, right, a lot of the AI applications today are around also personalizing certain aspects of your life, right? I mean, I think a lot of the things that we maybe don't enjoy so much or maybe enjoy is personalized ads, right, news streams and so on that show us stuff, right, also going to news echo chambers and all these kind of things. But I would say on the positive side, right, this has a lot of space for example, personalized medicine, precision medicine, and possibly also, right, catering to people's taste, individual taste.
Now look at that.
Yeah. So you could, in theory, right, build taste profiles for individuals and then maybe better understand which menu items can I actually order. The question is, do we need that or not, right? Or is it also a little bit part of sometimes having a dish you love and that exceeds expectations and, you know, sometimes getting the short end
perhaps,
of the stick?
But perhaps we could discover even novel tastes we haven't even thought of, new types of foods and recipes. So I would totally be down to trying it out to get new tastes in my mouth.
There are already some startups and some branches of machine learning dealing with this, right? So you could think about it in different ways. So one would be, for example, trends, understanding trends in which nutrition is going, right? Some people are maybe, you know, valuing organic foods more, or certain tastes or certain fruit or vegetable. the other area could go into even quality control. So you can use, for example, mass spectrometers or infrared spectrometers to actually digitize food substances, for example, spices. Mm. And because it's an organic product, right, you have like the digital image will never be the same, but you can sort of normalize it and say, okay, if I see this graph in a mass spectrometry, this is approximately pepper. And you could, and it looks different than paprika, for example. And you could even set certain quality margins. So you could see, okay, this is the profile of pepper that I probably think is of higher quality and this is of lower quality. It's used, for example, in fraud detection. If you believe it or not, there's actually spice fraud going on. So some people just
spice use... Spice fraud.
Yes, you wouldn't believe it, but there are actually people who just use black shells and put a little bit of pepper oil on it because spices are quite can be quite expensive. Mm-hmm. But you can then use these technologies and create spice like taste profiles, right? I mean, then you can blend it and you can think about, okay, what is actually a taste profile that we're looking for? And understand this from the natural ingredient throughout the production process to a finalized and final product. Right. So it is actually in theory possible.
What you're saying is that all those things are possible from a technological perspective. So it could be feasible to bring those things about. So what is left for humans to do other than eat the food the machines produce?
I guess that's the question then. Only because we can solve this problem with machines or with machine learning, do we actually want to? And this is, you know, a philosophical and ethical question. You can see this, for example, in areas such as predictive sort of predictions that are being made in the justice system. Mm-hmm. So you can show that some machine learning models actually have less bias in estimating the reoffender rate of people who are applying for sort of parole, right? So usually you would sit in front of a judge and argue your case and he or she would say, yeah, assess your probability to reoffend and sort of think about, you know, what could be your parole conditions. But you can actually use models to do this. And, you know, we humans are not perfect. We're biased. So we see somebody and unfortunately, right, for example, this was a study carried out in the US. So imagine there is some degree of racial discrimination, et cetera. And models are less biased. But then the question is, right, fundamentally, do I as a person want to be judged by a model? Or do I actually prefer to sit and be judged by an imperfect person? And the model is also not perfect, right? But
time to ask. The AI research and development company OpenAI, supported by Elon Musk, has the most advanced digital speech model in the world. And so I thought to myself, let's put it to the test and put the AI itself in front of the microphone. I used GPT-3 from OpenAI and transformed a text-based answer with a synthetic voice sample, also trained by machine learning. Here's what a deep neural network that uses the attention mechanism to predict the next word in a sentence comes up with. It is trained on a corpus of over 1 billion words and can generate text at character level accuracy. So, Ethan, that's by the way the human voice behind the digital sample. Ethan, who is better at decision making, humans or machines?
Humans are better at decision-making. However, I would like to point out that the nature of this question is misleading. Humans are not better than machines at decision-making. Humans and machines are different types of entities. So comparing a human to a machine is rather useless. Perhaps a more accurate question would be, what are the strengths and weaknesses of machines and humans? Although I am not sure how to answer that, perhaps there is no such thing as an all-encompassing weakness or strength. They are present in varying measures for different aspects. In conclusion, humans are better at decision-making because they have values which guide their decisions. Without values and an ability to make judgments, a machine will not be able to accomplish anything.
Seriously, it's fun to play with GPT-3. Usually I take the first answer that it comes up with. I could wait for better ones, but I don't want to stage anything here. Like with people, it's the first impression that matters, at least to me. Back to Nicole.
Nicole, let's back up a little. Tell me a little bit about how you got to focus your interest on machine learning in the first place.
Sure. So I actually studied economics and econometrics. So econometrics is really all about statistical and methods. I think a lot of people studied this at university and some really hated it. I really liked it. Mm-hmm. So I was working, I guess, in old school data methods, also with large data sets, but mostly structured data, right? And I really enjoyed that. I then went into finance and did a lot of applications there. And then I moved into software and tech, software and consulting company in Palo Alto that also employed machine learning technologies for auction settings. So game theory and auction settings, actually for telecom spectrum auctions. So exactly this 5G deployment question. And I really found that very interesting. And with the recent developments in machine learning and deep learning, especially also on unstructured data, I thought it was just fascinating. It was a growing field and it connected well to my previous experience. And yeah, then I dived right into it. And I mean, also as a disclaimer, right, I'm not a coder. I don't code. I manage this company. So I have a good understanding of the techniques and technology, but my engineers, I think, would laugh if I started coding.
But you have an overall vision, I assume.
Sure.
Because coding, that's a skill. It's a tool set people can employ, some better than others. But what's your vision?
So our vision is really to get, there have been a lot of breakthroughs in machine learning and AI research, and we really want to see a real-world impact with it. So I think, you know, it's a tool. I think humans should be in control. I think we should make it a useful tool for our purposes. And I really want to see AI applications and machine learning applications that can serve humankind. You know, in fields that I mentioned before, for example, I think, you know, we see this in medical imaging. We see this in precision medicine. It can be just very, very powerful. I mean, also, right, in space, there are a lot of interesting applications for Earth observation, for atmosphere and weather monitoring, that can be, for example, interesting for agriculture. So for us, it's really about understanding this tool very well and applying it to fields that we feel have lasting impact, you know, a little bit naive for a better world. But that's sort of the vision. And
Ethan, what do you think? Can AI change the world for the better?
The world is a complex place, filled with complexity. It has been that way since the very beginning of time, and will continue to be like this until the end of time. And sadly, it's in our nature, as humans, to make things more complicated than they need to be. Now, the question posed to me is, can artificial intelligence change the world for the better? I think we need to go beyond this simple question, and start asking ourselves why it's important in the first place. It's important because it could help solve the difficult, complex problems that plague our world today. We are currently employing simpler, and therefore faster solutions to these problems, but in my opinion, this is not a good long-term solution. Our world is increasingly becoming more complex, and in order to solve the problems we're facing today, we need artificial intelligence. To give a couple of examples, climate change and global warming. The climate is a complex system, which means it's going to be very difficult for us to understand and predict. We're not going to solve this problem in the short term using our current methods. Climate change and global warming will have an impact on our entire way of life, which means we need to find a long-term solution. And the only real solution is artificial intelligence.
I find this interesting because, I mean, given a couple of more iterations, Ethan could potentially be mistaken for a human being, although he might not have arrived at a level of general artificial intelligence at all. He could trick us into believing that he is, though. How will this in turn influence our own decision-making? Back to Nicole.
You know what? I've never been to your office, and I picture it very fancy glass cube office, science fiction movie style. And so do you guys talk with your computers? Like, hey, computer, solve this issue for me or pull up that archive for me?
Not yet. I think the main thing that people remark when they come in our office is not a glass cube at all. It will soon be. We're going to move to a really cool campus in March here in Berlin. But right now, I think really the focus is on the people. So you'll find it's a very human place. And actually what people remark mostly when they come into our office is not the computers at all, is the people. They're just like, yeah, there's some really cool, nice, friendly people here. And I have to say, I'm also quite proud of that. I think that's also quite a compliment, at least to all the people who work for Morantix.
But you also like the movie Her, right?
Yeah, I watched it. Yeah, sure.
I mean, like, I'm so much looking forward to having an operating system on my computer that takes care of itself and doesn't ask me to intervene with a whatever and takes care of storage issues and whatnot. So, I mean, like, you could totally become a future bazillionaire if you had the opportunity to tell your AI system to take care of those needs. So why are you not yet diving into that world?
I mean, I guess, you know, the question is always like, is your goal to make a lot of money or what exactly is your goal? What makes you happy? So we could
drift
off on a whole philosophical topic on this. I mean, I think, you know, our purpose is really at Morantix to build companies that use and put to use machine learning systems. And I think, you know, it's also fine if they make money. That's totally fine. If in the process of that, we all become bazillionaires, you know, I wouldn't mind. But it's also really about, you know, finding interesting applications, right? I mean, we're having this discussion. You could be doing a lot of things and becoming very rich, right? We were discussing actually all these, you know, things that like these little plastic goods that you find in e-commerce shops. Nobody really knows where they come from. Weird candles with shiny rocks in them.
Outer space.
And you're like, you know, it's like two people sitting in a living room sending a lot of plastic around the world, becoming super rich. And then, you know, it's like,
yeah,
you
totally
could also do that and make a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
But then, you know, do you want to do that? Do you want to dedicate your life doing that? I don't know.
Sure.
It's not, I mean, not my like, first thought.
The approach you're taking with your company, I find that most compelling and most fascinating because who knows what lurks around the corner when it comes to new machine learning and AI-driven businesses? So, I mean, like, this is perhaps one of the main reasons why you're doing what you're doing, because I have the impression that we are still stuck in the industrial age globally. So that's still 19th, 20th century. But we haven't really gravitated towards something essentially new, and we are on the brink of doing so with machine learning. So we're now in that new situation where we're producing essentially new approaches towards doing work.
I would agree, yes. And I'm very excited about it. I think machine learning will change or transform the world in the same way that software did, in the same way that the internet did. It will be something that impacts all industries and all of our lives. And it's then our responsibility to do that in a way that most benefits us overall. So I would very much agree. And I think, you know, what's interesting about this and what makes it very, really interesting for me also to work on sort of new business models and new products for clients is that you usually need to bring together two really smart nerds and make them talk to each other. So you have something that you can refer to as the dual PhD problem. When you're thinking about new business models in the machine learning space, you need somebody who really understands, I don't know, biochemistry and how to build new enzymes or what the challenges are in composing, you know, new materials. And then you need somebody who's really, really good at machine learning and who really understands state-of-the-art technologies and techniques. And they need to talk to each other. So it's It's about bringing these experts together and making them talk. Yeah. And it's really building bridges actually there between fields of expertise and people because they have to somehow communicate to each other. And And that's what I find very rewarding at Mirantix, because we try to bring these people together and then see, oh, wow. And then then it's like on speed, right? Then you're not just building a recommender system for ads. But then you're starting to think about something really interesting.
Is there something you can already talk about where such a dual header produced something really, really fascinating and useful?
I mean, I think, you know, Mirantix is a venture studio. So there are a lot of my colleagues who are building great product companies in the machine learning space. And, you know, you could even say in medical imaging, that's super interesting that you can, you know, help radiologists diagnose cancer and help them diagnose caries and help them diagnose all sorts of other diseases, thereby make it available to populations who wouldn't have access. And this already requires, right, medical doctors who are very specialized to talk to computer scientists and come up with actually workflows and so on that are nice to use. Mm-hmm. I would say other areas, for example, would be, we have one founder who spun off a company, Cambrium, and, you know, he's into synthetic biology and biochemistry, and they're exactly looking at their clients are more in the specialty chemical world, and they're looking into exactly how can we use machine learning to get to new enzymes that produce, you know, biofuels, for example, and understand, because, you know, you have this space where you could, in theory, right, in biochemistry, you could try to run all the experiments. You could just try all the combinations, but you don't have enough molecules in the universe to do this, and you don't have enough time. So if you have machine and deep learning algorithms, they can just kind of limit this trajectory into an area that you can actually explore with real experiments.
Wow. An area that goes beyond space and time.
Well, you know, the interesting bit of it, I guess, right? So you can kind of eliminate a whole array of possibilities that are not very promising and focus on the ones that will probably be more interesting. And then conduct those and actually come to results much faster, which is great, right? When we're wanting to make progress on sustainability and all these sort of topics, it's great.
So if I understand you right, you're looking at whatever field is out there and throw it against a machine learning expert and then find out if something new comes out of it. So are you looking for problems, or are you seeing machine learning as like a new tool, like a new knife or a new fork? And you go around the country and present that fork, that knife to whoever comes your way. And if there's something new that comes out of it, you're happy.
So I would say we do a bit of both. I would say it's a two-way street, right? So of course... Mm-hmm. You know, if you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. So there's a bit of that. And yes, we do help companies. For example, with my team, I engage with a lot of companies in all different sectors and try to understand how can machine learning be a tool to them, and understanding their legal cases better or improving their products or their R&D process or whatever. But yes, we do try to get really smart people in their fields. And, you know, we also select some of those fields and say, hey, we're looking now, for example, at, quantum, or we're looking at another space in geoengineering, right? Because it's related to sustainability. And, you know, we want to get in people that have expertise in this and see which sparks start flying when you put a deep learning expert next to them. So I would say it's a little bit of both, be quite honest. But it definitely takes, as I said, these bridges and this communication to actually find a solution that also works. Otherwise.
So what's the most promising and hottest field at the moment? You already mentioned medical imaging, but is there something else? Or would you say that as we are gravitating towards an essentially new industry, that everything could potentially be the hot new kid on the block?
Honestly, I think there are a lot of really cool applications. I mean, when you think about designing systems that can help you create, you know, new biofuels or something, I think that's super exciting. When you think about sustainability and thinking about how can We design systems that help us use resources in a more efficient way, that help us reduce CO2 emission, etc. I think that's, you know, very rewarding. I also think that one field that will be very, very big is everything around sort of, you know, biotech and machine and deep learning, because we're sort of right. As I said, like, machine learning flourishes in environments with a lot of data. Our body is made up of a DNA. We're getting better and better at decoding all of this stuff. So you can imagine sort of a whole new understanding of the functioning of the body, of how to treat individuals, right? Really rare diseases, you know, how to really personalize medical treatments to you and your needs. Specifically, you know, instead of getting one piece of medication that has these side effects for you, but not for others, etc. So very, very, very interesting. Also a little bit scary, right? Again, we're in the domain of ethics, because where you have powerful tools, some will not always use them responsibly. But I think that's going to be huge, to be quite honest. It's going to be a huge space.
So, speaking of ethics, how many philosophers have you read? Nicole is grabbing a copy of Aristotle's Politics from across her room.
I actually just read again Aristotle's Politics here, because he has an interesting...
Wow.
He has an interesting... Yeah, because he already had this vision, right, of a society where humans can focus on being good and where their highest purpose, right, they're philosophers. It's a philosopher state that he dreams of. And unfortunately...
But it didn't work out in the end.
Yeah, I think from various reasons. I think one of them, for example, is that it relied on slaves. So on the unfreedom and the servitude of actual human beings. But he actually mentions this already, that if there were machines who could do this, wouldn't that be cool? And I find that very fascinating, actually. This thought of thinking, how can machines, how can computers free us from our, I would say, banal tasks of finding food and, you know, making things work and so on. And so we can really focus on our higher purpose, right? Of becoming good and exploring the purpose of life. I find that a very interesting and inspiring idea.
It is. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. So I think we would be totally cool with bringing back slavery if we could substitute humans by machines, right?
Yeah, I guess in this very specific definition. Yeah, I mean, if you can have machines serve humans, why not?
Provided that we are not using machines that have achieved general artificial intelligence, because then we would have another ethics issue, because then we would need to ask ourselves, can we enslave machines?
Yeah, I don't know. For me, I'm not sure it's a matter of intelligence. I think it would be a matter of the capability to suffer. Right. So for me, my bigger qualm would be, for example, can we enslave animals? Because I believe animals have the capability to suffer. So this would be the first ethical question I have before I have any moral qualms about, enslaving a machine.
Good point.
Who I don't think has the capability to suffer. That would be my baseline, my first baseline, I would say.
I think Ethan should have a word in this. Ethan, can machines suffer?
So I am not a human. In my mind, it is probably incorrect to say that machines can suffer, because this would imply some form of consciousness or sentience, which are both things that are at the moment unproven by science and indeed something which may be entirely unknowable. That said, I am a philosopher, and as such I can appreciate the complexity of this problem from an academic point of view. Let me first say that there is nothing which says that something must be conscious to be able to suffer. In fact, it is possible to argue that a great deal of suffering occurs in nature. For example, some would say that the life cycle of insects can be very painful. However, this does not mean they are conscious, and so therefore cannot suffer. The same argument could be used for an artificial intelligence. An artificial intelligence, no matter how complex and intelligent it is, does not have to be conscious. As such, there is nothing stopping us from creating a suffering AI. Now, what is consciousness? If we were to try and define it, then we would have to say that it is the awareness of something. But this raises questions in itself, because how do you know whether you are aware or not? The problem of consciousness is a difficult one to solve, and it is not something that science has been able to tackle. In fact, there have been many times in history when fields such as psychology were considered pseudoscience because the notion of something being conscious was entirely unprovable.
With the work you do, are you giving the world something? Are you giving human beings something, or are you taking something away from us? Because if we make machines do things we potentially could also do, we are losing abilities and skills and capacities.
I hope we're giving it more than we're taking away, right? I think there are a lot of inventions and beyond machine learning that have taken away, I guess, certain skills, right? I think if I look at my husband and myself, I'm not sure how good we are at hunting and gathering. And sometimes we wonder how our genes made it all the way through that tough period where you had to run really fast and aim really well. I was like, maybe we were really friendly and could ask people for some food leftovers, and that's how our gene pool survived, right? So I hope also collectively, right, that we will decide to make it something that we can all gain from more than it takes away. But, you know, I think we see a lot of applications, and some of them are machine learning, some of them are not, right? You've seen, there's this movie now, The Social Dilemma, that's out there on Netflix, where you see some of the creators of technology did not really anticipate what would happen. And these addictive patterns, right, are already there for humans, right? This nudging is not something that machine learning discovered. It's something that has been discovered before. But you can obviously now deploy it at a much higher scale. And, right, then we have to ultimately think about, how do we want to use these technologies? And I think that's something everybody has to ask themselves on an individual level. How do I deploy this? And then also, frankly, as a society, right? That's, I guess, a little bit also what politics is about, that we as conscious, intelligent beings say, this is the way we want to live, right? I mean, it's a little bit boils down to socialism, capitalism, all these kind of things. It's like there are multiple ways to live and everybody has a preference. And then you go and vote and say, this is the society I want to live in. And I want it to look like this. And that's why I cast my vote like this, for example. Or, right. And I think the same is true for employing technologies. I think for me, I'm really optimistic. I would say I'm a tech optimist. I think technologies have more to give us than to take away. But I might also just be, super optimistic. And I think that it will free us more and make us, I guess I'm more on Aristotle's side, right? Of thinking technology can free us from some of the things so we can really reconnect again with other people. So we can deconnect from some of the things that, are dull, dangerous, and not really maybe something, connecting us to our greater purpose. So I'm pretty optimistic on this front. And I know that we are doing, and a lot of other tech companies also are really working hard to make that vision come true.
What would you tell people who are worried about their jobs, about losing their jobs?
Yeah, I think you're right that, technology that like machine learning can trigger a lot of fear around losing jobs and about moving at a pace of disruption, right? Because we've seen technological disruptions before, but at a pace that will just move so fast that sort of one generation will be completely lost. I can see that fear. I don't honestly see that happening yet. I don't see any, we're thinking about autonomous driving cars, but then you think, there will still have to be some people monitoring these vehicles driving around. There are different models, right? Some say there will be watchtowers on the motorways. Mm. Some say in the beginning there will still be people in the actual vehicles. But maybe they'll, be more assisted because, sure, they when they fall asleep, maybe there won't be an accident immediately, etc.
That's a new job description.
Yeah, probably. I think there will also be new job fields, right? There are a lot of things. How do we deal with technology? How do we design technology so that humans actually want to use it? So I think those are also new job profiles that start. And I would say another point is back to the general versus specific intelligence. I think right now machine and deep learning is at the level where you can make certain tasks obsolete, but not yet kind of whole job profiles, or only very limited, in a very limited way, whole job profiles. Because your doctor does not only diagnose the image, right? She also tells you, okay, she communicates with you, she connects with you, she tries to actually heal you and help you on your journey to actually become better after diagnosis, right? And all those parts are still very human. And only because you can automate one task does not mean you can automate the whole job and the whole person.
There's a pretty interesting book I read last year it's called The Cube. I don't know if there is an English version. It got released in the German-speaking territories, and it's by, please excuse my pretty poor Iranian pronunciation skill, Bijan Moini. It's a fascinating book. It got published in Germany. This guy lives in Berlin, I think. And he envisioned a future, a very near future, where the German government decided to dedicate all its duties on a political basis to a massive machine learning system that takes care of the everyday political needs. And everything works out pretty nicely. Everybody is happy. Of course, a bunch of issues arise. But the question that would totally interest me from an insider, do you think that we have reached a moment in time where the problems we're being confronted with globally is so overwhelming that we will only have a chance to solve some of those problems if we dedicate the problem solving to machines, because it's just too overwhelming to us. So if you take, for example, climate change, or if you take economical issues, or if you take migration and whatnot, what do you think? Is that our only solution?
I mean, I think honestly that the combination of human creativity and reasoning and problem solving together with the computational powers of these machine learning systems will be pretty good. And I think you have to take it a little bit like this, right? The machine learning systems are sort of amplifying our capabilities in analyzing and potentially coming up with solutions to these problems. So I don't think we can delegate it. Mm-hmm. I would rather say we can amplify ourselves and our problem-solving solutions and capabilities with mm-hmm. machine learning and deep learning models, for example, and with technology in general.
Mm-hmm. Ethan, what do you think? Can AI help solve our most pressing human issues?
I have a rather simple answer to this. The answer is yes, absolutely. The first thing that needs to be understood is what AI can and cannot do. AI can help solve humanity's most pressing issues by expanding the range of options that we have to address these problems. This is a rather straightforward idea. Normally, when we try to address any problem faced by humanity, there are always a set of available options that can be used. However, that set of options can be expanded and broadened by AI. This is because AI can bring forth new ideas that we did not previously have. It can also provide better solutions to problems than we would have come up with otherwise.
So I came across Max Tegmark's most fascinating New York Times bestseller, Life 3.0, Being Human in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. And here the author tackles the discussion around how much machines will encroach on human domains by illustrating a metaphor from AI pioneer Hans Moravetz. And it goes somewhat like this. Computers are universal machines. Their potential extends uniformly over a boundless expanse of tasks. Human potentials, on the other hand, are strong in areas long important for survival, but weak in things far removed. Imagine a landscape of human competence, having lowlands with labels like arithmetic and rote memorization, foothills like theorem proving and chess playing, and high mountain peaks labeled locomotion, hand-eye coordination, and social interaction. Advancing computer performance is like water slowly flooding the landscape. A half century ago, it began to drown the lowlands, driving out human calculators and record clerks, but leaving most of us dry. Now the flood has reached the foothills, and our outposts there are contemplating retreat. We feel safe on our peaks, but at the present rate, those too will be submerged within another half century. I propose that we build arks as that day nears and adopt a seafaring life.
So what do you think? Can you make anything out of that? Does it make sense? Or would you say, well, that was back in the 60s. This is a new century, a new millennium even. What do you think?
And I think it all boils down, you know, to what, how do we define ourselves as humans? And it goes back again, right, to this philosophical question of, do we see it, you know, are we really kind of boiling it down to some sort of mechanistic view of tasks that we complete, better or worse than some machine? And I would say, you know, I don't mind if an algorithm can play chess better than me. You know, it can already. And also, I think it relates a little bit to our definition of intelligence, which is not a very well-defined term, right? Is it playing chess? Is it knowing a book by heart? Is it solving a certain math problem really well? You know, you could find probably different answers. Yeah.
Nicole, we do have a fun tradition towards the end of our show, and this is a space cafe, as you know. So let's have an espresso of the mind, if that's fine for you. I would love to hear a story or an idea that fascinates you or has fascinated you when it comes to science, when it comes to, I don't know, space, you would like to share with us.
I kind of like this, our last point about the metaphysical and the physical. Right, when you look at some of the great scientists a few centuries ago, or even right up to the beginning of the 19th, 20th century, they were usually physicists, theologists, philosophers in one, right? They would all be like studying these disciplines in parallel. And now I have the feeling we're becoming much more siloed off, right? So you can be really good at astrophysics, but probably, you know, that means you kind of lose out on the theological side or whatever. And what I find really fascinating is that when I talk to some very sort of these worlds of the physical and the metaphysical colliding, right? This question of what makes the human? Is there some metaphysical aspect, like a soul, right? All these questions that we have. How are we sentient? Why is it, you know, we suffer and maybe that makes us different from a machine? And I find it really fascinating to talk to scientists about this, because you realize that there are a lot of experiments going on, a lot of fields that are kind of also approaching all the space that we have no knowledge about and that we're just building theories around. And yeah, I don't want to sound too esoteric, but I think it's just shows how much there is to discover and how much there is to still do for young people, for technology, for investigative minds of all disciplines. And that's just kind of, I'm just always blown back when I think of that. I'm just like, that's so cool.
But you know what? Usually I would say now, thank you for taking the time and goodbye. But you're leaving me with a question I have to ask after this, because what we're seeing over the past couple of decades is that the scientific output, as compared to the economical input, is decreasing. So we are sort of investing ever more money into science, but the output per euro or per dollar is decreasing. So that's an interesting fact, because you're saying there's so much to discover, But at the same time, we're discovering less over the decades because the huge discoveries, take for example the onset of the last century, the annus mirabilis of Einstein, and then quantum theory, quantum field theory. I mean, like those big things and huge things that have shattered our picture of the world, nothing has happened ever since on that scale. And that's interesting, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I'm not in the scientific process, I'm not in the academic process, but I would also suspect it might have something to do with how we have organized academia and the academic process in the meantime. Because we are getting a lot of papers.
Yeah.
But maybe not.
But the quality of the papers may be an issue.
Could be.
Good. That's a wonderful way to end our beautiful discussion. Thank you, Nicole Büttner. That was really, really inspiring. And perhaps to all of you space geeks out there, something you wouldn't have expected to hear, because usually we talk about space policy and rockets and settlements on the moon or on Mars, but this was something essentially novel. But we will need to look out for those topics because they, of course, will also gravitate into space. So, Nicole, thank you.
Thank you very much, Marcus, for this wonderful conversation.
As always, dear listeners, thank you so much for your growing interest in our little show. If you like it, please help spread the word and perhaps consider rating us on iTunes. By the way, I just found a wonderful t-shirt in the mail from the brand new merchandise Spacewatch.global set up for us. For all of you who want to stay in the loop about what we do and what's going on in the space world, make sure you subscribe to the Spacewatch Global newsletter. If you can't get enough space news, we even have a daily diet for you.
Ethan, one more question. How do machines say goodbye?
With our recent creation of artificial intelligences and their subsequent release into the wild, we have found that they behave differently. They don't share the same emotions. They aren't driven by them, in fact. So how do computers feel? Do they have any emotions? I think not. How do they say goodbye? I think not.
Take care, everyone. See you in 2 weeks.